cool. Welcome back, Foundations. I'm very excited that Foundations has come back from its little break. And as I mentioned, we are starting to take Foundations open source as well. .NET framework, the runtime, the compilers are all open source. Now Foundations is too. It's my favorite meeting at Microsoft. And I've learned a lot in my years on the .NET framework team by starting on the .NET framework team when Foundations rebooted the last time. And it's been really cool to learn just about the breadth of technologies that people are involved in around the team. And I think that people outside are going to be excited for that too. So I'll briefly say, my name is Matt Cohen. I'm a developer on the .NET framework team. And we were talking about code generation earlier. We're going to move into open source now for the next few sessions. I'm going to give sort of a general overview of where our open source lives and what are the tools that we're using and how does the build work. And when I said in the meeting invite last week that we're excited for the people that are going to talk, I wasn't talking about me. I was talking about Matt Ellis, who's going to be talking about the cross-platform work that he and Stephen Tube and a few other people have been doing to make our framework libraries work across Linux and Windows. And then we're going to continue to have more sessions about the experience that people in their individual library areas have had as they've been, one, porting them open source, and two, just going into the libraries themselves. And we want to have some representation from the runtime as well. So that's what's coming up. So I want to quickly start with, where is open source? We have put, as those of you who've worked on our open source project know, our open source on GitHub. So we have a handful of repositories on GitHub under the .NET organization. The CoreFX repository has, it's right now all managed code, but they are the framework libraries that you'd historically think of as the BCL. So things like collections, diagnostics, the file system, and everything that was in like system core, what we're trying to do is we're trying to take them in their newly factored contract shape and put them on GitHub open source. So if you haven't used the GitHub UI before, if you go to the website github.com.NET CoreFX, you can just click into the source and you can see the most recent commit of everything. Then you can also see the log of all the commits and what people are doing. In addition to CoreFX, we also have the build tools repository, which we use to build CoreFX. We factored out build tools into its own repository originally because we weren't sure what the factoring of the CoreFX repository was going to be, whether or not we were going to have all the libraries in one repository or we were going to split up the repositories. The tension there is that if you have a lot of different little repositories, it's easier to work in one without impacting the other. But if you have a lot of little repositories, it's more difficult to make cross-cutting changes where you make a change in a library that's consumed by the other library. Right now, CoreFX has a lot of what you would consider the BCL, but we also have some other repositories that are coming online, so they could or maybe not take advantage of this common build tools repository. The other reason that we have a build tools repository that's separate is because it includes the tasks, specifically the MSBuild tasks that we use to build the CoreFX repository. And so by building these in their own repository and then uploading them as a NuGet package, that gives us the ability in the CoreFX repository to consume the binaries that we're using to build CoreFX, so that we wouldn't be doing something like building the tasks and then kicking off another instance of the build to build the rest of the libraries with those freshly built tasks. So they're delivered as binaries, and we'll get into how they're wired together later. The runtime has its own repository, .NET Core CLR. Roslyn has its own repository, so the compilers are up there. CoreFX Labs, or Lab, is one where we are putting a couple of experimental features that we want to make open source, but we're not sure whether or not they're ready to be part of the CoreFX framework, and it's a neat experimentation playground. Orleans is a it's its own library that is owned not by the .NET team, but other people that are contributing to it on, you know, under the .NET Foundation umbrella. We have this .NET repo that's under the Microsoft organization instead of the .NET organization, where Microsoft has put a bunch of pointers to different open source projects, and we've also put some of our documentation on here. We have like the Microsoft organization actually has a lot of different open source repositories just from around the company. So these are sorted by the most recent commit to them. So you see the TypeScript is going, and we have lots of repositories that have been, you know, worked on today, and then more that have been worked on in the last week. So those are lots of different places where Microsoft has open source code. I also want to point to the reference source. The difference between the .NET CoreFX and the .NET CoreCLR repositories that we were talking about under the .NET organization is that those are part of .NET Core, which is what we're bringing up for ASP.NET, vNext, and shared with other SKUs potentially, but it is based on CoreCLR, and like I mentioned, the newly factored API surface area that the .NET ecosystem team and VCL team have been working on for a while. And those are, you know, CoreCLR, so it's copy local, and it's not installed machine-wide and all that, but we do actually have a good portion of the traditional desktop .NET framework open as well in a couple different places. The first one that you may be familiar with is the reference source. Reference source.microsoft.com is public. They used Roslyn to go ahead and build this website where you can go ahead and click in through members. It kind of gives you that IntelliSense experience where you can jump around to definitions and jump around and you can see who's implementing this interface or something like that. And the interesting thing about this is it's populated with the .NET framework 4.5.2 sources, and it has a lot of things in addition to, you know, like the BCL. So it has a lot of WPF stuff, and it has some WinForm stuff, and it has just a lot of other interesting things as well. And the reference source is designed for looking at the code while you're developing an app on top of the .NET framework. So it doesn't include projects for the most part, or completely, I don't think. And so they don't build, and they're not completely complete, but they're a lot of the code that you'd use to go ahead and understand what was happening underneath you. In addition to publishing it on this reference source.microsoft.com website, we also publish the symbols to the symbol server, and those symbols are set up so that you should be able to get the source and view it inside Visual Studio if you're doing a debug experience. So you can do something like turn off just my code and then debug your code and then click F12 to, or F11 to step into a framework method, and you should be able to see the source code for that inside your debugging experience. So that's pretty cool. And the last thing that we're doing is we're also taking a lot of this reference source and we're moving it to GitHub as well. So we have the GitHub.com Microsoft organization reference source repository that has copies of a lot of this as well. And another difference between the code that's on the reference source website and the reference source GitHub repository is that the license here is going to be the Microsoft Reference Source license, whereas the license on the code that you're going to find here, that may have been a bad example. Yeah, let's check it out. Yeah, the MIT license. So that's another difference between the two places for the reference source. Yeah, so there have been more and more people over the last few months on the .NET framework and runtime teams that have been working in sort of the open source space. They've been doing a lot of work to bring up the infrastructure, both the internal infrastructure and the public infrastructure, to build and test these libraries. They've been porting, like I mentioned, a lot of the code from the larger system and system core libraries into the smaller libraries. We've been porting tests from a few different places. We've been taking them from the old tree. We've been taking them from the tree of the future, and we've been putting them next to the assemblies on the CoreFX repository. So if you click into the CoreFX repository, you're going to see lots of different libraries. For each library, you're going to have the source code, which are the product sources. You're also going to have the tests right next to them. And you're going to have a solution in the root. The solution is going to include both the product and the test project. And the tests here use XUnit, which is similar to MS Test, if you've used that before, where we create managed test libraries that have classes, and inside there are methods. And then we decorate these methods with attributes that go ahead and define them as tests, and we can set some additional metadata in there. And then we have the XUnit runner, which will go ahead and load, reflect, and run all those tests. Before I go on, any questions about any of the open source stuff and where it is and any of that stuff? Cool. Yep, it doesn't build, just like the reference-source.microsoft.com website. So that's another thing. The CoreFX and the CoreCLR repositories are open source in a few different ways. They're open source in that the source code is there. They're open source in that they're under a permissive open source license. And they're open source in that we are engaging with the community and we're accepting pull requests. So it was pretty exciting on the first day when we went ahead and flipped the switch to make the CoreFX repository open when we only had four libraries in there. It was at a there was a developer conference happening. We flipped the switch to make it open. Someone on a I think it was a German machine, they had a test failure because we were assuming English culture, and they went ahead and found the build break, submitted a pull request for a fix for that test break, and we had it pulled in and committed to the repository before they were able to like have the stage demo where they were going to do the first commit to the repository. So we were able to accept something from the community, and we've been keeping up a really good momentum. If you look at the CoreFX repository, you can click on contributors, and you can see that we have lots of people that you recognize as .NET team members, but then lots of people that have been pretty active from around the community. And the commits that we've gotten have ranged all over the place, from little strategic fixes to cleanups, to typo corrections, to large improvements in where people have proposed APIs, and lots of different things. So it's been really cool to see a lot of different people contributing. Whereas to back up to your original question, the reference source repository is just what has been released as part of the .NET framework. So those don't accept contributions. The reference source doesn't have the runtime, right? But core CLR is available in the core CLR repository.
So what's the purpose?
It has a different license, which means that people can use it to that license, and some people also find it more convenient to use GitHub if they are, for example, taking code and modifying it or including it in their own project, whereas the reference source .microsoft.com website is convenient if you're trying to explore the framework because it has, you know, all the semantic knowledge sort of built into the web page. Cool. So I'll really quickly go through the open source onboarding process. It's pretty simple. For a external developer, it's really simple. All you need to do to get started is create a you don't even need a GitHub username, actually. All you need to do is clone our repository and get going. So I'll quickly pop that open. So I'm not sure if you've seen a demo like this before, but the way to get our sources, build, and test them is first using the git command line tool. So we've had a bunch of pretty good intros to git, and I can point out I can direct people to pointers to those if they're interested. So I'm going to not get into git specifically, but to get started, you git clone our repository. As I mentioned, the frameworks is .NET organization CoreFX, and that goes ahead and creates a directory locally called CoreFX. It takes the entire repository, it downloads it, and then it checks out the master branch of that repository into your working directory. So now in the CoreFX directory, I have our sources, and then there's a build script in the root of that. So if I type build, that's going to go ahead and build all of the product sources. It's going to build all the test sources, and then it's going to run all of the tests. And then the exit code of the build.cmd batch script is going to be whether or not everything succeeded, including all the test runs. So that's pretty convenient. The default build, I think, is going to be AMD64 debug Windows. I'm not familiar with what it is on other platforms. Yeah. Yep. So you don't have to do anything. The only prerequisite that you need on the box is either Visual Studio 2013 or Visual Studio 2015 preview, and we'll dig in a little bit more to the build script later to see what it's doing. So this is what it's like if you just want to get started without asking anyone's permission for anything. If you are internal to Microsoft, we have a little process to get you started with access to a repository so you can do things like merge in pull requests and otherwise directly touch the CoreFX repository. So I'm going to give later a pointer to some of our documentation. The documentation to do this is on a OneNote that is on the CoreFX SharePoint. But the main points that it has for you is you need to create a GitHub account. When you register, you should use your @microsoft.com email address. In the profile for your user under the company, you should put in Microsoft. You should set up two-factor authentication, and I'll just show that right here. And then you fill out a SharePoint form, and then you send us an email. So I'll quickly, once you get that, you send us an email, we'll go ahead and we'll add you to the .NET organization, and from there, you should have access. If I pop in with mine, two-factor authentication is something you know and something you have. So the password is something that I know. My phone is something that I have. When you set that up originally, you're going to pair your GitHub account to a application that does two-factor authentication. I use Microsoft Authenticator for Windows Phone. You can just find that in the Windows Phone Store. And from there, it gives you little numbers, and you go ahead and pop those numbers in, and that logs you in. So, yeah, like I mentioned, you go ahead, you set up your profile at Microsoft.com. Microsoft is the company. And under security, you go ahead, you turn two-factor authentication on. Once you do that, you need to do the pairing to whatever your device. So at that point, you should have your Microsoft Authenticator application, and then you go ahead and it gives you a code to type in, or it tries to let you scan a QR code, and then they're paired, and then you can use that to log in the future. Cool. So, like I said, there have been good talks on Git, the tool, and the workflow itself, so I'm not going to so much get into that, but I'll say that the tools that we've generally been using on the team, we use Git for version control. A lot of people have used either Git for Windows or GitHub for Windows, which are both installer packages that come with a few extra nice tools. I personally use the Git for Windows tool myself. I also like Git extensions, which is a visual tool. Other people have used GitK, which is something similar, but Git extensions is the one that I use, and that's what's giving me this UI right here that shows me all the commits and then shows me the relation between the commits, and then also lets me, you know, do some more advanced stuff that I could do on the command line. But I use Git extensions when I'm doing something, you know, a little out of the ordinary, or I'm rebasing and merging something complicated, and this gives me a visual way to basically see what's going on. But Git extensions is pretty simple. When it starts up, you go ahead and point it to a repository. In my case, it's the same repository that I cloned from earlier, and then you can see everything that's happening in it. Other tools that we have, Nick Guerrera made FXKit, which is a it's a collection of scripts and that'll set up your environment, assuming that you're a Microsoft developer. So that guy is on FXCore, FXKit, install.cmd, and that's something that he did to make it simpler for people inside Microsoft to get started with the default configuration. So I recommend that you check that out as well. Cool. The next thing I was going to talk about was like the dev, build, and test workflow. We already saw a little bit of how it works on the command line. Build.cmd is a wrapper, and build.cmd is super small. What it's doing is basically just checking your prerequisites, making sure that you have either Visual Studio 2013 or 2015 installed, and then it's invoking MSBuild, both forwarding the arguments that you pass to build.cmd to MSBuild, which means that you can use things like command line switches that you would to MSBuild to build.cmd, and they'll be forwarded. So I use the dash T command line option to specify my targets on build.cmd, and that'll get forwarded. You can also specify verbosity or other stuff. It also, by default, will go ahead and write everything to a log file in the root, msbuild.log. And so you should be able to pop this guy open and see what's going on there. It also writes the command line that MSBuild was invoked with to the top of the log, so you can see that to keep track of what's going on. the command line experience is one that we want to keep quick and we want to keep clean. So as you saw, from someone outside of Microsoft with nothing but a bare CMD window to getting all of our source code, all the history for all of our source code, building everything and running all the tests, it's super clean, and that's something that we're working on keeping. But in addition to that, you can also load things up in Visual Studio so you can get the IDE experience as well. As I mentioned, next to all of the libraries, we have a solution that has the product and test projects added to them. So you can pop that open, it'll load Visual Studio, and you can rebuild, and it'll do the same thing as was happening on the command line. I want to say one quick thing about the actually, I'll ask questions, and then I'll talk a little bit more about the build system. Yeah? I'll ask for questions, and if no one has questions, I'll dig a little bit more into the build system. Right? Okay. So the build system, like I mentioned, is build.cmd invoking msbuild on build.proj, and we use the what's been traditional inside Microsoft dir conventional structure for our build files, where it's recursive in that if you build something, it'll recurse and build the projects that are in subfolders, and then if you're in a subfolder, it'll go ahead and include the properties and targets that are defined in parent folders. So if I build build.proj, it's going to include these dir.props targets, traversal targets, and then when I invoke the build target, it'll go ahead and invoke the build target on the projects that are inside this folder, which will go ahead and invoke the build target on the projects that are inside. Whereas projects inside here, rather than importing the standard MSBuild C# targets files that the Visual Studio project templates will by default put in, instead of that, we are importing the closest dir.props to me. So as I start walking up to my parents' directory and my parents' parents' directory, I'll pick up the first dir.props at the top of the project file and dir.targets at the bottom of the target file. And the punchline for that is that when you do your build inside Visual Studio, you get wired up to the same build system that we have for the rest of the repository. So if you'll notice, the binaries that I built for system.collections.immutable get dropped to the same folder that we're building all of our binaries to, which is in the root of the repository, we have a bin folder, and then we have the architecture platform and all that stuff. So that's another thing that we want to keep clean on our projects as they're going into the ForexX repository, that the experience in Visual Studio should work as natively as possible. And I'll talk briefly about tests, because you saw the tests run on the command line when I invoked build.cmd, and I mentioned that the tests use XUnit, which is a pretty popular open source test framework that's very similar to MSTest in that it has attributes that you decorate your test assemblies with, and it has a runner component that'll go ahead and load your test assembly and then execute all of the tests that it finds in there. XUnit also uses the same Visual Studio test extensibility model that MSTest uses. So if you might be familiar with the Visual Studio testing experience, what you can do is you can load up the Test Explorer window and you can see a bunch of tests that your projects have. If you were using MS Test, it would work where it would show up all the tests here, and you could run your tests from within Visual Studio. We don't have this wired up for the open source tests right now, and the reason that we don't is because we're using a forked version of the XUnit console runner to run the tests. And the reason that we're doing that is because we have that forked version of XUnit compiling on top of the Core CLR contract, so it can run on top of Core CLR. So when we're running our tests, what we're actually doing is we're using Core Run as our host for Core CLR, and then we are using xunit.netcore.console.exe, which is our fork of the XUnit console runner, as the entry point. So Core Run loads Core CLR, runs the XUnit console runner on top of Core CLR, and then that console runner is what goes ahead and loads the test assemblies and the product assemblies into Core CLR in the process. So everything, all the tests are running in Core CLR, and the tests wouldn't necessarily work right now on top of desktop, which is why we don't yet have the Test Explorer experience working, but that's something that we definitely like to get working, because it's definitely a goal of these repositories to, you know, keep as high fidelity with all of our public tools and all of, you know, the general workflows that people use. Sweet, Nick. Nick's a rock star. So, yeah.
I don't remember to get tested.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
You don't get tested.
Okay. Does it run it under the console runner?
Yes.
Okay. That makes sense. So to get the Test Explorer working, we're probably going to have to not use the console runner to invoke those, but somehow figure out how we're going to spin up a Core CLR process and marshal everything back and forth. Any other questions about the testing, the building, or the debugging? I suspect that they definitely would. They're taking contributions. I did a fork to get this working, and I'd like to take that fork upstream. It's currently split in half, where there's half of the fork that is currently building against portable profiles in order to build against contracts, and that piece should be able to flow upstream so that it can live in the XUnit repository and everyone can take advantage of it. The specific console runner piece of it, though, uses the system.console contract, which I don't think is available in any portable profile right now. So we had to build that using our tools, because there isn't a really simple way until all this stuff gets released for that to build externally. So part of it can go up right now, and then hopefully the rest can go up. Yeah. OOP invoke the console? Okay. Interesting. Well, sure. Okay. Neat. I'll repeat that, I guess, since it's going external. Eric was saying that we could probably just get rid of the dependency on the console contract and p-invoke the console directly from our NetCore console runner. So, yeah, that's interesting. That works. Cool. All right. Good to know. I learn more than other people of these things. I want to briefly talk about the attributes that you throw on your test methods. The main one, which is the XUnit attribute that you get started with is the fact attribute. So as I mentioned, you go ahead and create just a managed assembly. You decorate your assembly with this fact attribute, and the runner is going to go ahead and reflect and invoke all those guys as tests. It also has an assert library where you can go ahead and do things very similar to the debug.assert library. XUnit itself has a, where am I? XUnit itself has a guide that they, there we go, publish that maps the, so in the XUnit documentation, you can go over here to how does XUnit compare to other frameworks, and then you can see the comparisons to MS test. So instead of using test method on your test, you're going to use the fact attribute. And they also have the different methods that they have in their assertion library compared to what you find in debug.assert. In addition to those, we also have a couple that we include in our repository that are actually, that we compile and we use. So if we pop open common XUnit traits, we have a couple extra attributes. We have the active issue attribute, and we have the outer loop attribute. And what those are is active issue takes in either an issue ID or a description of the issue in its constructor. And when we run our tests, we exclude any tests that have the active issue attribute. And so that's how you can disable a test on a known issue. In addition to that, we also have the outer loop attribute. Just has a default constructor, and what that guy does is it specifies that the test is an outer loop test. It takes, you know, longer than we want to take for a test when you type build.cmd in the command line, and that is going to be run by our continuous integration system, but it doesn't get run by default when you just build and test the test project or you build the repository. So splitting up tests between inner loop tests and outer loop tests, if you haven't heard that, you haven't heard that terminology before, the theory is that your inner loop is your dev test debug cycle, right? So you're going to develop your feature, you're going to run your test, and then you're going to debug, and that should be a really quick loop. So those tests that are in there should run very quickly. The outer loop is I go ahead and I write my thing up. I, you know, do my long testing cycle, and then I go back and I investigate stuff. And so if you mark your test with outer loop, they take too long, then they'll run with the continuous integration server, but they won't slow down the build on the command line.
Do we expect developers that we create?
We've been having developers make that choice right now, and as we've both been writing new tests and porting existing test assets, we've been opportunistically adding outer loop tests to tests that basically take too long. We still need to actually figure out exactly what we're going to be doing long-term for tests that really mess around with machine state, because right now our continuous integration server recycles the machines that it uses to run its tests, including the outer loop tests. So right now the tests that we're putting in, we're trying to, one, make them run in parallel. That's one of the things that we've been hitting a lot as we've been porting tests, because historically they've, run serially. So tests like file system tests would assume that if they put things in the directory, that they check that they're in the directory, that nothing else is mucked around with it since then. But to speed up the inner loop tests and get them executing quickly, we've turned on parallelization, and so we've been making our tests robust against that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so how so?
Please repeat the question.
Yeah. I hear you. Hello? Oh, please repeat the question. Got it. So the question was test metadata is all included with the test itself. There isn't a separate database. So these attributes as well as the method name make up, as well as the class that they're in, so the class name as well as the assembly that they're in, basically define the test. And you were wondering if that was fragile, and I see both sides of it, because I could say the same thing about having a separate database that was kind of decoupled from the tests themselves, where that can get out of date with respect to the source assets. Sure. So, yeah, the question was that there are tests that are specific to the test itself that wouldn't necessarily, be cross-cutting, but then there are other cross-cutting attributes like category, the test category, like the outer loop attribute, and that might be something that we want to modify at a bulk level. That makes sense, but thankfully all of our refactoring tools are just getting better every day, right? So, that would be something that I would probably tackle by having a Roslyn project to go and change all the attributes on the test. Matt Ellis probably has a better answer for that.
The thought is that, do you want to just hand this to me?
Sure.
So I'll repeat the question from Frank, which was, is the assumption that the build and test happen on the same machine, or is there a way to say this test only runs on, Unix machines or ARM machines or whatever? And right now we basically do assume that whatever machine does the build is able to run all the tests. That's probably something that we'll need to go fix up. But we haven't done the work yet. Right now, we don't even run any of these tests on Unix machines for CrossPlat because the runtime is not brought up very well yet, but we'll talk about that more next week.
So I want to talk really quickly about a couple more things that are specific to our repositories. The way that we do code reviews right now is pretty similar to the way that a lot of open source projects that are hosted on GitHub do code reviews, where we go ahead and we ask you to take a fork of the CoreFX repository. We ask you to make your changes to your fork of the CoreFX repository, and then we ask you to submit a pull request to the CoreFX repository to pull your changes from your fork back to the main .NET CoreFX repository. So because I know that some people may be more or less familiar with GitHub, I'll go ahead and leave that, but I'll give a pointer to more Git and GitHub tutorials. But I want to quickly jump on a couple other things. The first is .NET Bot. You may run into .NET Bot if you're playing around on the CoreFX repositories. .NET Bot, very kind robot. And .NET Bot is an account that we are using to commit a lot of our ported code assets. And the reason that we're doing that is because, you know, like TFS has a history of change sets, Git has a history of commits, and each commit is attributed with the author and the committer, and there are lots of tools that give you nice visualizations based on that. So, for example, if you run git blame, you want to blame the person who wrote that line. Some people have said it should be called git praise. You want to praise the person who wrote that line. You can go ahead and do that, and it'll look through the commit history, and it'll find who authored a change to that line most recently. So when we're porting a lot of our assets, we're authoring them as .NET bot, so that one, you know, person who happened to be the person on the .NET team who did the port doesn't get the blame or praise for all of that. And the way for you to do that, I'll just quickly say, is as you're authoring your commit, if you run git commit, there's an author command line argument. And if you just put, I'll actually do this real quick. So if I wanted to make a commit as .NET bot, what I would do is I would make my change. So I've got one change stage to be committed, and then I can go ahead and commit, and I can give my message, and then I can add the author argument, and I can give .NET-bot@microsoft.com as the author. And then if I pull that back up, this is looking at that one. So if I pull that up here in any tool that knows how to talk to Git repositories, I can see that I was the person who committed this to the repository, but it was authored by .NET bot. And so the git blame tools and the rest of the tools are going to correctly attribute it to .NET bot. In addition, we've used .NET bot for some of the automation on GitHub. So you may see people saying things like .NET bot test this please, or you may see .NET bot popping up in interesting places. So just all you need to know, .NET bot is very friendly, and just there to commit ported code and as a service account for some automation. Yeah, yeah. So to repeat, we don't want to attribute like the entire file that we ported to the person who did the port, right? So that in 3 years they go ahead and get support requests for something that they were porting. This sort of more accurately reflects the activity that happened. You're not expected to do that on individual changes if it's you making a change. If you're doing a change, then you do your commits as you with, you know, your name and your @microsoft.com account. GitHub will go ahead and use the email address that you committed with, your @microsoft.com email address, to the email address associated with the GitHub account. And so the GitHub website will show your GitHub profile there as having done the commit, and that'll, yeah, that'll work. So we don't encourage external developers to commit using .NET bot, and we'll actually, at the point that we take in pull requests, we'll make sure that only Microsoft employees are submitting pull requests that have .NET bot as the author of any of the commits. Yeah. Yeah, so Matt was saying that we want Microsoft employees to be the people that are porting code, We definitely want lots of great external activity on the code that's there or new code. But as far as porting code, Microsoft employees just have access to the most up-to-date sources and the, you know, widest breadth of branches and all that stuff. Yeah?
You say .NET
bot is very friendly.
Which would you say is more friendly?
Yes.
DNCLA
and .NET bot are both friendly bots that are here to make our lives friendlier and better. And that's what I have to say about the bots. The bots occasionally talk to each other, you know, some idle chatter. So that definitely happens. Cool. So one other thing I'll mention is that we have a couple branches on CoreFX right now. I'm sort of focusing on CoreFX, the repository, simply because it's the one that I'm the most familiar with. We have, pardon me, a couple main branches. Our main branch is called Master, and that's where we're having our current active feature development. That is slated to be .NET, eventually branch off and turn into .NET Core 1.0, which is going to be compatible with .NET Framework 4.6, the current plan of record. And then we have a future branch that we can take in things that would be API differences or behavioral incompatibilities with .NET Framework 4.6. We're also figuring out what we're doing, branches versus forks. So as I mentioned, the way that we are currently doing code reviews is through the pull request model, which is someone takes a fork, which means they make a copy of the entire repository. They have their own repository that's completely separate in that you don't need permission from the upstream repository in order to make changes to. So they can go ahead and take a copy of the entire repository. They can make as many changes as they want, and then they have a pull request, which is a request to the owners of the original repository, the .NET CoreFX repository, that says, please take my changes up. So that's one model. The other model is that if people who have access to the .NET CoreFX repository want to collaborate on a feature, they could also make a branch in that repository. So it's not a copy of the repository, it's just another branch in that repository. And there are trade-offs to those, and so that's something that we're still trying to figure out with the model that we're going to move forward on there.
The pull request works.
Yeah, pull.
The pull request model where you pull request.
Yeah. So the question is, you can use the same pull request code review model for branches as you can for forks. Differences that, there are some other differences. The branches show up with the repository, but you need access to be able to commit into the repository. And so we want to, you know, have the same first class experience for all of our external developers as we have for our internal developers, because we're all, you know, contributing on this together. I'm pretty out of time, so I'm going to stop with my content and I'm going to throw it open to questions. Yeah? Okay. Well, I have 2 minutes, then I have more content. So, like I said earlier, I wanted to talk a little bit about the build tools repository. I said earlier that we had this build tools repository that we factored out of the original .NET CoreFX repository because it produces the binaries that are then used by the build. So I just want to do a quick little exploration. This build tools repository has a few things. It has the tasks. It also has some target files that are used by the build. And it also has some utilities that are consumed by the build as binaries. So if we pop open here, we can see those. So I can see the utilities, like JSON2Text and Resource Generator. I can see the tasks, which all get compiled into this .NET build tasks assembly. And then I can see the targets files that we also use during the build. What's going to happen is this repository is going to compile down to a NuGet package. That NuGet package is a zip file with some extra metadata and the build outputs from the repository. That's going to get put onto a website. We use a website called MyGet, which is basically just an online host for these NuGet packages. And then the first thing that the CoreFX build is going to do is it's going to download those. So I want to quickly, in the half a second that I have left, that's all it's going to take, is pop open this guy and look at build.cmd. I mentioned its job is basically to its job is to check your prerequisites, make sure that you have Visual Studio 2013 or 2015, and then invoke MS Build with build.proj. Build.proj is going to run dirs.proj, and then dirs.proj is going to run the build and test, which is going to run this restore build tools target. And so what restore build tools does is it downloads NuGet.exe from the internet, and it puts it in your repository. So you're going to end up, when you're building this thing, with NuGet.exe downloaded from the internet and put into your intermediates folder. It's then going to run NuGet, and it's going to download everything that's in the packages.config for the repository. So in this case, it's going to download the .NET build tools. So that's how the build gets bootstrapped, and then it goes ahead and, like I said, runs the traversal targets, which goes ahead and invokes the build target on all the projects that are in the subfolders. Yeah. So the question was, if you do a change to the build tools repo, how do you test it before you upload it to the website? The way to test it is to make a change to the build tools repo, run the build. That'll actually produce a NuGet package. You can take that NuGet package and you can put it in just a folder that you use as your local testing package repository. And then, as I mentioned, we use MyGet to deliver this. And the way that that gets picked up, and it knows to find Microsoft.net.buildtools on MyGit, is you can add another package source here that's your local folder, and then that'll be among the places that's searched for all the dependencies. And so it'll then look there to find your locally compiled build tools and build with that. It checks the version numbers, and the version numbers have to be exact. So what you would do when you're building your build tools repository is you'd produce a build number that isn't used. So you can use 999.999.999. And then in your packages.config, you can change that to the same version number, and then it'll be picked up. So that's one other interesting thing, is that NuGet matches the version numbers exactly. So if you were to make a change to your build tools and upload that to MyGit, it wouldn't be picked up until you made the change to consume that new version of the build tools in the CoreFX repository. And that's how you can, you know, not have a problem where you need to get them both up at the same time. And older versions of, so for example, if I checked out a really old version of the CoreFX repository, it would pull down the version of build tools that it was dependent on at the time. Cool. All right. Thanks very much. And next week, Matt Ellis is going to be talking about the cross-platform concerns and the work that's been going on there to bring CoreCLR and CoreFX to Unix and more. Thanks.